Taylor Molly by himself, the impetus of proofreading off his album Conviction. I'd like to ask all our listeners to donate to KABU. The drive is ending soon on September 20th. You can donate on the KBOO.fm website on the Give page. I'd like to thank Marcus Lattimore, Drew Slum, and Dante Graham Preston for their poetry tonight. And we're going to end the show now with Marcus Lattimore reading his poem, Maybe.
Maybe this time around, I'll grab the jacket in the closet that says truth. Maybe when I put that jacket on, it fits, but stands out. Maybe they'll laugh at my flavor and mock my choices. Maybe in the midst of my audacity to fashion how I please, I'll be condemned, beat up, and tossed in garbage. And maybe when I'm dead and gone, someone finds my jacket and says, how did this design end up here?
KBOO Portland.
Can't get enough of the Ghost of Hollywood? Check out our entire first season, now streaming wherever you choose to listen to your podcast. And don't forget to like and subscribe.
While you're at it, check out our website at theghostofhollywood.com so that we can keep you up to date on all the latest with the Ghost of Hollywood.
Go to kabu.fm/wakeup to support KABU during our Wake Up the Neighborhood Fall Membership Drive by grabbing limited edition KABU merch. You can support local community radio in style with your choice of t-shirt and hoodies in Pavement Black, Snow White, Oregano Green, Cherry Red, and Sandy Beach. That's kabu.fm/wakeup to get yours before they're gone.
This is the Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I am Grace Cavalieri, and we have a feast today of poetry, playwriting, screenwriting, novel, Esperanza Hope Snyder. And she's going to start with one of her own poems.
La Violencia. We once drove past a barricade, a dozen men standing in the middle of the road at night, waiting to slice us open with machetes, cut our throats with the motion of the hand. I remember the episode, remember the night, eerily dark and quiet, the men blocking the road, motioning for us to stop. We came close enough to see their eyes. Grandfather, surprised by his own strength, insisted, "Drive on." Our driver paused, confused, before speeding past that wall of flesh, machetes glinting in the dark. I never understood how anyone could keep on rescuing my brother and me, teaching us what to love in the world, what not to fear. Some nights, I look up at the sky, trying to find the stars I studied as a child, thousands of tiny pins shining. It made me feel small looking up at them. In the Colombian darkness, their brilliance was all I had.
The voice of Esperanza Hope Snyder. What a story. You have so many untold stories. What is this book going to be?
This book is going to be a combination of a weaving of these stories that you mentioned, Grace. A continuation of the first book, which also told stories of the different places where I've lived and the experiences I've had. There will definitely be a part about Colombia, which is something that I always, a country where I was born, a place I love, a place I have very mixed feelings about at the same time. So still working through those emotions and those experiences. And of course, there's going to be more about my life in the US.
Yes, born in Bogota. You've lived in Tuscany, Madrid, West Virginia, but your stories about where you came from in your childhood are still unfolding, which is so interesting to me. There are just never-ending things that you have yet to tell us. Esperanza Hope Snyder, when you wake up in the morning, do you say, I think I'll work on my novel today, or I think that I'll continue translating someone's poetry? How do you meet out your various projects? Because you have about 10 on your desk.
Well, I take them, I approach them one at a time, Grace. I've put poetry aside at certain times. I'm working on a novel at present. And so I've been, for the last 2 months, I've focused on the novel, but I always go back to poetry, regardless of whether I've been working on a screenplay, a novel, a translation. I always have to go back to poetry.
You are a poet who writes a novel. You are a poet who writes a screenplay. This is clear. How many pages do you have already accomplished for your new book?
For the poetry book, I have about 45 pages.
Mm. And do you know where it will be published yet?
Not yet. Not yet.
We know one thing, it will be published. I know Sheep Meadow did your last book and it was very beautiful. And Stanley is 97 this week.
I know. So,
that publishing house has been going on. We'll follow your meteor, Hope. We will. And now I really want to focus on your own poetry in Spanish and English because it is dazzling. I watched your performance in New York recently. So do you begin with English and translate to Spanish?
Yes, yes.
Okay. Uh-huh. Well, give us two and start with each English one and please set it up for us so that we know the content. And then after you read the Spanish, we will hear the English and see how much we understood. All of us had high school Spanish.
So would you like me to read the English first or the Spanish first?
Let's go with the Spanish first.
Okay, so the context, this is a poem about Madrid, one of the cities where I've lived, and it's about the neighborhood where I spent some time and a description of my experience there. So it's titled Calle del Príncipe Madrid, junio 21, 2019. Por una ventana abierta, un perro ladrando invade mi habitación. Sinfonía de llaves perdidas. Abajo, cerca Plaza Santa Ana, los hombres se saludan, pequeños príncipes perdidos en un planeta lejano. ¿Es ese sonido de espadas contra espadas el que asciende a la cuarta planta? Melodías de hombres afilando sus vidas. Hoy, el solsticio. Y la luz madrileña aún a las 10. Una acuarela que nunca se seca. That's Spanish. English. Calle del Príncipe de Madrid, June 21st, 2019. Through an open window, a dog's barking fills my room. Symphonies of lost keys. Below, close to Plaza Santa Ana, men greet each other, little princes lost in a faraway planet. Is that the sound of swords, striking swords, I hear rising to the fourth floor? Melodies of men sharpening their lives. Today, the solstice, and Madrid's sunlight, now at 10 p.m., a watercolor that won't dry.
A symphony of lost keys is in itself a poem. It opens up and evokes so much possible. Let's hear another.
So this is La Catedral de Sal en Zipaquirá. It's a salt, it's a mine. It's a cathedral in outside of Bogota that was built in a salt mine. And it's very interesting to visit. And you have altars, you have, it's huge. You even have a tourist shop and it's really way below. So this poem was inspired by the cathedral. La Catedral de Sal en Zipaquirá, Colombia, 2017. Nunca se trató de Dios, sino del oro. A los españoles les gusta corregir la historia igual que a mi madre en español y en inglés. Quesada, como queso en español, la primera lengua que aprendí. Permanezco sentada en la catedral, un santuario esculpido dentro de una mina de sal, un templo oscuro sin ventanas que los muiscas una vez minaron. He venido aquí a rezar, a arrodillarme frente al altar bajo una cruz de alita iluminada desde lo alto, a oler el incienso que quema. Ruego poder cruzar el océano de nuevo, ruego no encontrar mi maleta flotando por río frío, porque me estoy cansando de correr, porque me estoy quedando sin palabras para explicar cómo crece el río dentro de mí ahora como entonces. Es difícil olvidar el arte del abandono, ya que he tenido buenos profesores toda mi vida y me han enseñado cómo hacerlo. The Salt Cathedral in Zipaquirá, Colombia, 2017. It was never about God, but about gold. Spaniards like to revise history, as my mother does, in Spanish and in English. Quesada, like queso, cheese in Spanish, the first language I learned. I sit in the cathedral, a shrine carved inside a salt mine, a dark, windowless temple, the Muisca's mind. I've come here to pray, to kneel in front of the altar under a highlight cross lit from above, incense burning. I pray I cross the ocean again, pray I don't find my suitcase floating down Rio Frio, because I'm growing tired of running, because I'm running out of words to explain how a river swells inside me now and then. Hard to unlearn the art of living when I've had good teachers all my life to show me how it's done.
So much direct truth, so much authenticity, no showboating, just like an arrow to the heart. Esperanza Hope was the former writer in residence at Hood College, former poet laureate of Shepherdstown, West Virginia, and the start of the Society for Creative Writing at Shepherd University, and served as poet in residence there. I also want to know about your translations now, because you are now veering out to translate other poets. Who is Wendy Guerra?
Okay, so Wendy Guerra is a Cuban poet and novelist. She's written several novels. I discovered her book of poetry in Bogota over 10 years ago, a while ago, at a bookstore, and started reading it and just loved her outlook, her diction. It was fresh. It was also describing the Cuban experience, the experience of a woman artist living in Cuba. She's now living in Miami, and since the pandemic, I believe, I think the pandemic caught her in Miami, but until then she was living in Cuba, traveling because she's also a French citizen. But she wrote a novel, Todos Se Van, Everyone Leaves, which actually was adapted to film and has a very interesting perspective. I really like her work.
How fortunate for her that you found her book in a bookstore. How providential, because we would never know her otherwise. I mean, there's a little bit of magic here. I will know her work. Had you not walked in that bookstore instead of the hat store next door, we would not know her. It is so circumstantial, but so miraculous in a way. Thank you for that service. I'm serious about that. And now for the service of your own, give us back your own poetry. Give us two of your own poems in English.
Okay, so many wars. Tuscany 2000. Even after I moved my suitcases to the villa, the old man, my boyfriend's uncle, refused to grow flowers, said they weren't edible. I can't imagine living 90 years without tasting roses. Such a loss, like soldiers dying in a war far from home. Summers, until Chernobyl's death clouds came, I gathered zucchini, tomatoes, fresh basil from the garden. Most afternoons, the old man napped in the rusted green Skoda my boyfriend's ex-wife once drove into the lake. Hands raw from digging in the overgrown garden, I recall the first time the old man knocked on the door, asked for sweet coffee. Mm-hmm. Between sips, he said, "During the war, I kissed a French woman." "What war?" I asked, but he had forgotten. Evenings, after watering the plants, he rides his Vespa into town, back to his wife. But talking about the woman in France, he cries. Oh, how the heart sings remembering love. I walk by the vineyards, hands clasped, a mother waiting for her son to return from war. The villa is now painted blue, windows in my old bedroom open, curtains shiver in the light. After the old man died, I spent his lire, the war pension he gave me, on creams and perfume talcum powder. What war? I don't know. Just like I don't know if he had to kill another man to earn his medals. When the woman who drove her Skoda into the lake finally got it right, my boyfriend sent her roses for the funeral.
Esperanza, that is a poem I will teach because of the shifts. You go back and forth against story across time, volta, 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 shifts and different energies. I will teach that poem. That is one to remember. Keep going.
Love poem for my brother. When my mother brought him from Colombia at 15 to start a new life, to make something of yourself, he had never washed a plate or made a bed. In grandfather's house in Bogota, my brother's rare forays into the kitchen were to steal from the maid. After school and ESOL class, Miguel would walk into shops, ask for work in broken English. After weeks of begging the owner of a pizza parlor, he's in a kitchen washing strangers' dirty plates. Maybe that's why he moved back to Bogota for 2 years and sat at a Zen center, breathing in and out, accepting change. Now in West Virginia, for 8 months, he's been sitting at my kitchen table, staring into space. I talk chopped onions, tomatoes, steamed rice, boil water for pasta. Today, he emptied the dishwasher, held a wine glass up to the light.
Mm. What a good line. What a good last line. You know, you have in your former writings discussed a chaotic childhood and transference to different countries, but don't you think that was all to the good? Don't you think that made you the poet, the layered poet that you are? I can't think of it otherwise. As difficult and difficult as it was.
Absolutely. I wouldn't change any of it, Your Grace. I would not, because I think it made me who I am, and it gave me the desire to voice my experience. And I just can't imagine not having those experiences and not being able to write about them.
Yes, I want everyone to know that you are the author of Esperanza and Hope, which is a very clever title because Esperanza means hope, and it also means the virtue and condition of hope. And then a play, The Back Room, which I have read, and two novels, Orange Wine and Holy Viagra. And that will be a new forthcoming book of poems from her and a new forthcoming co-translation of this Cuban poet we talked about. So one more poem in English before we find out how to write a novel.
All right, Dancing in Bogota. In this city, when sunlight dances, rain, mountains in the distance, buildings and more buildings, until the eye falls on green trees, green clouds, crowning the mountains, heat rising in crescendo throughout asphalt streets. Women in this Bogota walk swinging their hips, indifferent to the weather. Soft bodies gliding through the city's streets. There's sailors sailing on Odysseus's ship, though also sirens, seducing, playing sweet, rain clouds floating above endless labyrinths. As a child, I cried every night in this Bogota until I heard my aunt sing, felt her hands reach for me in the dark, her warmth as we waltzed to her bed perfumed with roses. Dawn found me in the crib alone. Some other wouldn't know my aunt, broke her promise.
Oh, so much richness there, so much sensuality, and so much mystery. You know, it's hard to think of a poet being a novelist because a poet's energy is a burst, and a novelist is really the long distance runner. So what is the novel you're working on now?
Well, the novel I'm working on currently is the story of a young girl, and it's starting in Colombia. So I decided to write a novel rather than a memoir because it gives me a lot of freedom and it will be more fun because I'll be able to include all kinds of ideas and thoughts. So it's the story of it's a woman's story from childhood until, you know, middle age.
And where are you in this novel? How is it completed?
It's not completed yet. Holy Viagra is completed. This novel is probably part one is completed.
It's your third
yeah.
novel.
Yeah.
Wow. And the other two are published?
And the other two are with my agent, Madison Smart Bell.
Mm. They'll get there. They will get there. We'll probably have three out at once. And so you start with a character and you start with a situation. Do you know where you're going to go, or does it? Is it a form of self-discovery?
That's an excellent question. Well, the first novel was inspired by my grandparents. So I started with their story, and I started with what I remembered about their story and what I found out about their story, their love story. But throughout the process, as I wrote about them, they were no longer my grandfather and my grandmother. They were these two characters. And I took them wherever I wanted to take them, which was very liberating. And in the end, I changed their story.
How do you know when to stop a chapter?
I write very brief chapters, actually. So I stop. It's an intuition. It's not something I don't have a. But the only rule I have is that I don't write very long chapters. I write, short.
I totally recommend that. And what little I know, when I teach writing, I say, our span of attention is really much different from what it was in the 19th century. And those short chapters, I love that when I read a novel with shorter chapters. So would you say 5 pages is a short chapter?
Yeah, 5 pages. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I've read your play, and I know it was produced in New York. And so how do you write a screenplay? I mean, how does that point of view change? How do you start with a visual? How did you start your screenplay?
Well, it was quite an interesting. It was an interesting experience for me because obviously I wrote the play, and then a former student of mine, who's working in L.A., read the play and said he wanted to direct it, and so that obviously gave me the impetus to start working on it, and so I started reading screenplays. And I started following it's very different. As you know, there's such a focus on action happening, less on dialogue in some instances. So I just basically focused on the action, on actions by the characters that I maybe had had much longer monologues and dialogues and so on. So I tried to do that. But then Antonio Nardolillo, the director, also brought in Oscar Torres, who has accolades. He actually has won some awards for screenwriting, and we collaborated. And I learned a lot because Oscar gave his spin on things, and then I knew what I wanted to keep as far as what I had created. But I learned an awful lot also working with him. And it's already completed, and we're waiting to see if someone would, you know, if it moves forward. But it was quite a learning experience.
Oh, what a fascinating thing you did. How long in the making? How many months?
Oh.
A year? Well, 2 years?
Yeah, about 2 years. And, you know, what's interesting about this, Grace, is that the theme of the play, and, you know, because you read it, is about a presidential candidate, a woman who's running for president of Colombia and gets kidnapped by guerrilla fighters. And so then it all happens in the jungle, and there's all kinds of plots and twists and so on in the plot. And there's a comandante guerrilla fighter who's the comandante, and they've known each other before, but she doesn't know this, and he knows, and so on. What's interesting about it to me is that the recent elections in Colombia, a former guerrilla fighter was elected for the first time, a leftist-leaning man, for the first time in the history of Colombia. So I got goosebumps because I thought, regardless of when I started writing this, it's real now. It was almost predicting a future.
Art precedes history. This is right. The guerrilla fighter is the new president of Colombia. This ought to be very good for your PR, I hope.
I hope so.
And so let us hear a little bit of your novel. We're going to go back to your novel, and the title is
Holy Viagra.
This is Holy Viagra. And tell us a little bit what we're going to hear, and then let's hear some of it.
Yes. And this was fun. This was fun to write. So I'm starting. Chapter 1. Roberto Embarrada stood at the door of the Bogota Hilton waiting for Dr. Smith. They walked to the parking garage. Smith managed to get in the Volga without hitting his head. He was too tall for the car, too tall for the country. Roberto, the doctor said, squeezing in, I don't understand why you insist on driving this Russian antiquity. I have contacts. I could get you a Cadillac. Imagine cruising down 7th Avenue in a red Cadillac. I'm sorry, Mr. Smith, Roberto said. I mean, Dr. Smith. I'm attached to this car. A car is like a woman, you know, and I'm faithful to my cars. Smith laughed. Okay, amigo. And what about your women? That's a long story, doctor. Where to? Do you want to visit the plastic surgeon in the north of the city? Or should we go back to the angel specialist with whom you dined last night? Neither one, Smith replied. I don't know if the angel specialist can really talk to archangels, but her angelic face could drive me to sin. Roberto smiled as he looked at the doctor in the rearview mirror. So that's what you like about her, her pretty face? Did she say anything interesting during dinner? He asked. It's not just her face, Roberto. I'd be willing to spend a weekend in hell for the rest of her body. I don't remember what she said. She spoke too fast, and my Spanish is not that good. Smith laughed. But that was last night. I don't have time for hanky-panky today, amigo. Today, it's all about business. Take me to San Andresito, he commanded, handing Roberto a piece of paper with an address on it.
Oh, we're so glad to see that playful side of you, because there are many sides to Esperanza Snyder. And now let us have a final poem.
Okay, so for the final poem, I would like to read The Waiting, which is a poem also about Italy, because as you know, I also love Italy. It's titled, Wings. Wings. That May, on the airplane to Milan, my thoughts turned to leaving, to cutting ties, lies, burning letters. Flying into Malpensa Airport, I flew into a new life, a new love. Dusk and mornings, I opened windows to a sea of vineyards, a sweet scent of grapes ripening, the gentleness in me like deer standing in the dawn mist. Summer afternoons, I took my daughter to the pool, watched her float in armbands. Chlorine on our skin, water all around us, Petrarch's cypress trees lining the road, the Tuscan sky above us. She learned to swim her first summer on Earth. I dreamed of giving her wings like Daedalus gave his son. Who knew Icarus would plunge into the sea, searching for freedom? Who knew that after 9 Tuscan summers, love fading out of me, my thoughts would turn to leaving, to taking airplanes, a suitcase, and a child? Everyone forgets that Icarus also flew.
The voice of Esperanza Hope Snyder. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. This series is produced by Forest Woods Media Production. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MAT Studios. We wish to thank the library for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Snippet Fund, by Sandy Jackson Cohen, and the Anne Arundel Arts Council. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Independence. Not being subject to another's authority or jurisdiction. Grassroots. The common or ordinary people. KBOO, a community radio station that supports both. Go to kboo.fm/give between now and September 21st to donate and help us reach our $30,000 fall membership drive goal to wake up the neighborhood.
This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're with Joyce Kornblatt, all the way from Australia. So tell us what the book is about, Mother Tongue, the characters, and a little bit of the story.
Well, Mother Tongue, which is my fifth novel, is about, I can say this from the outset because it's on the first page, it's about a baby who is abducted as a newborn from a hospital in Pittsburgh and taken by her abductor, who was a nurse in that hospital, successfully escaping the police to Australia, where the mother lives incognito, you know, with an alias for the rest of her life. And so the main character, Nella, grows up thinking herself a child raised in Australia by her birth mother, who had a sad life in America, doesn't like to talk about it, so gives herself reasons for the distance and the lack of information. And well, when her mother dies,
this is a fascinating book with a fascinating plot. So I want to start right off with you reading a bit of it, please. Mother Tongue.
The very first two pages from the first section, which is narrated by Nella. My name is Nella Pine, and this is my life story, as new to me as it will be to you who reads it here for the first time. I am the secret, and the one who whispers the secret into your ear. I am the crime, and the narrator sleuth. I came upon the facts of my existence as one who returns to her home in the midst of a burglary. Here is the shattered glass, the rifle drawers, the thief with the booty still cradled in her guilty arms. When I was 3 days old, a nurse named Ruth Miller stole me from the obstetrics ward in Mercy Hospital and raised me as her own. This was May 7th, 1968, in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. In Paris, 10,000 students rioted in the streets. Martin Luther King had been dead for a month, and Robert Kennedy's killer struck in June. The war in Vietnam was at its peak. In the midst of these larger convulsions, a smaller one, deadly as napalm, precise as an assassin's bullet, in the form of a nurse who kidnapped a child and vanished from sight. I was a healthy infant with a head of dark hair and an iodine stain shaped like a butterfly in the center of my brow. During the futile search for me and my abductor, that marking would become famous for a while. The butterfly baby featured on news reports and front pages and missing children's flyers in post offices and community centers and supermarkets all over America. By the time the authorities abandoned their hunt, the iodine stain had faded away, my most distinguishing characteristic no longer there to identify me. And as often happens to babies born with a full head of hair, that too was gone. I looked so little like the photo snapped of me in the hours following my birth that Ruth herself could begin to believe that I was a different infant entirely, not the one she'd taken from a mother in room 32B, who slept through the deed in sedated postpartum oblivion. At the end of her shift, Ruth lifted me from my crib in the newborn nursery, settled me into a sling she wore beneath her raincoat, and walked out undetected into the balmy Pittsburgh dusk. Smoke from the steel mill still turned the air rancid and yielded sunsets of exquisite and memorable radiance. If I had not been stolen away, if I had been able to witness again and again the evening sky of my birthplace, I would have learned early the lesson I'm struggling now to accept. Beauty resides in blight, and blight in beauty. Each holds the other like a seed in its hand.
What a writer. Joyce Cornblatt is the author of 5 novels, short stories, reviews, and essays. She's received the O. Henry Award, an Atlantic First Prize, a grant from NEA, a D.H. Lawrence Fellowship, and the Towson Literary Creative Fiction Award. And she was a professor at University of Maryland. You know, Joyce, when I read this, the story is about obsession, of course, but I have to say, under the line, there was a writer's obsession. What was your obsession that made you write this book that tears your heart out on the page?
Oh my, that's a very big question. It is there. And I would have to say it's early childhood loss in its many forms, both from the point of view of a child and from the point of view of a parent. And it's been a theme that's arisen in my life and my own family in various forms. So it's not one foreign to me, although, of course, the kidnapping is completely foreign to me.
Well, that's the power under the line, Joyce. I mean, that is the context for the wound, because this story did not come, and it is not a superficial story, and it is the intensity of the writing that got me so impressed and involved. Not only the story, which is a page turner, there's something that happens every page, but this throbbing pain beneath the line, it is really one of your most powerful works. How do you think it's different from your other novels?
I think it's different, Grace, in the sense that I finally, at this stage of my life, had the courage to fully enter this pain. And I would say this pain is not just of my personal life and generation, but it's intergenerational. It's the Holocaust. It's the whole Jewish history of loss and displacement that I could finally step fully into psychologically, spiritually, and really try to understand it as a a great human challenge that people need to meet in many forms.
Yes, in many contexts. Loss is a hard thing to write about and to create stories and characters about, but loss is so large. How do we get our arms around it? How do we gather it in our arms except through humanity? If you take a string from one character to another, and every character has to have a storyline, one to the other, you can think of the complexities. What are the complexities here? Because I think there are questions that are being raised in this book that make it complex. What I know that you wrote it, so you may not have parsed it out this way, but what do you think are the complexities in your book? Besides loss and the human entanglements.
One that I had to sit with a lot because it kept arising in the writing as organic, and yet I was afraid that it wouldn't feel that way to a reader, is the whole notion of coincidence, or what Jung called synchronicity. So there are so many characters in this book who have all in one way or another experienced significant and in some cases catastrophic soul-destroying loss. And I kept asking, can they all be in the same book and have come to know each other? And I thought, yes, they can and they must. That this is a more universal human experience than is often spoken about. It's often the tragedy that's denied, repressed, hidden, secreted. And I wanted this to be a book in which each character who spoke and the characters they spoke about would have a place to be able to be real and to be heard and to be genuine about their own heartbreak and their courage.
It's a lot to do. It is a lot to do. I'm sure you didn't think of all this when you started, or we'd never have gotten into it.
I did not have a plan for this book. I remember sitting in a cafe, and I hadn't written fiction for a while since my prior novel, The Reason for Wings, and the first couple of sentences came out on the page. My name is Nella Pine. This is my life story, as new to me as you. I was abducted at birth, and I was as shocked as I hope a reader is reading those lines. And then I began to see how metaphorically this could have arisen from this body and mind.
Well, we're talking about how you write a novel, and in this case, you're sitting in a cafe, and the novel comes to you. Is that different from what you experienced before? Is that the first time that's ever happened?
Yes, for it to come whole in the way that it did, and it came whole in other aspects as well, it was like receiving a dream. Whereas my other books came out of lived situations or research I'd done, and kind of evolved gradually, you know, the writing, discovering the writing. But this came whole without any sense of how I would achieve it on the page. You know, that would reveal itself, the craft of it. And I didn't have a sense that it would be multiple voices. I couldn't imagine how I could write this book.
I really was going to ask you that. I was going to say, well, after you get up from the cafe, is it a character that gets a hold of you some kind of way? Or is it the story? Or do you have an idea? I mean, how did you take it from that blast to methodically develop the story? How did you do that? Was it with little white cards, little white index cards with plots on them?
No.
How did it shape itself? How did it shape itself?
It was an 18-year struggle. It was a novel, like 18 years. My other books I wrote in 2 to 4 years, 18 years coming and going from it. Many times setting it aside, thinking, I can't do this. Either the craft is too difficult or it's too painful. But it kept calling me back. I wouldn't say I returned to it. it came for me. And when I realized metaphorically that there was encoded in Nella's abduction the depth of pain I felt as an almost four-year-old when my parents moved from the home of my grandparents where I'd spent my first years while my father was away in the Navy during World War II. My parents then decided to move from that household in Boston to Pittsburgh, my father's hometown. And I never saw my grandparents again. They died within a year. And really, my grandfather had been my father, as I hadn't met my father until I was almost 3 years old. And that loss, I would come to discover later in life, was probably the most significant trauma of my entire life. And there have been others that followed, but and it happened at a time, you know, when the inner world of children wasn't really acknowledged or understood. And so from my parents' point of view, they tried to shelter me even from the fact that he had died.
Mm-hmm.
And also they, from their point of view, I couldn't really be suffering.
Of course. Children have no interior lives. Children
no interior life. I was with my parents. They loved me. Mm-hmm. So there was no place for me to express, to process this great grief, which I came to see later as a client of a therapist myself. Was responsible for a good deal of childhood depression and confusion. Where is my family? I would think sometimes, and then think I was going a bit crazy because I was with my family. So in that way, I felt like my subjective experience was one of a stolen child who didn't know from whom she was stolen or why she felt stolen. Then I could see this is my story.
If pain has beauty, if pain is transformed to beauty, there is the resurrection of this, all this. Well, we want to hear more. And so please carry us further and farther and deeper into this book. It's called Mother Tongue. Mother Tongue.
This is toward the end of Nella's section. And she's speaking here about her husband, Alex, an artist, a Sydney artist who she's married. And I'll just read you the first couple of pages from this chapter. Alex said his real name was meant to be Hector. Hector, the great Trojan hero. Hector Zavros, son of Daphne Zavros and her secret red-haired Irish boyfriend, Patrick O'Farrell, who worked with her after school at a milk bar in Liverpool Street in Sydney. Once after their shift was finished, they got into his secondhand Holden and drove out to the park where Patrick knew of a hidden place beyond a stand of eucalypts and dense grevillea shrubs, where he met up with mates on a weekend night to drink beer and talk about girls and sex. This was a Wednesday night, September 1967, it wasn't the first time for Patrick, but it was for Daphne. When she realized she was pregnant, Patrick quit his job at the milk bar and told her he would ruin her reputation if she ever divulged his name as the father. "I'm a kid," he told her. "I can't go having a kid myself." Alex learned about Daphne from a daughter she had, Marina, his sister, who found him 25 years after Daphne had been forced to sign the adoption papers without even having a chance to hold her newborn son. "She didn't tell any of us about you until she got so sick right before she died. That's Lorena. A heart valve replacement that went wrong, a heart they hoped to fix, failing before she even got home from the hospital. I think it was heartbreak that did it," Lorena said. "No surgery can fix that. Not after all those years of private grief." Daphne hadn't wanted to give up her child, not even when her parents sent her away to the home down the coast, 5 hours from Sydney, never coming to visit her, much like the other girls, 20 of them, children really, alone with the nuns who treated them more as delinquents, remanded to their care, and teenagers desperate for reassurance and mothering. Before she went to the home, Daphne had collected baby clothes in a cardboard box. She covered herself with flowered wrapping paper, 3 baby fleece rompers with feet in yellow, green, and white, little animal printed t-shirts she found at a secondhand shop, a pair of crocheted booties, and a matching cap, no doubt made once by a doting grandmother, say, who couldn't wait to cuddle her grandchild once the baby arrived. She kept that box with her for the rest of her life, hidden away, and only told Lorena about it when she revealed how Hector, that's how she always thought of him, was taken from her in the hospital delivery room before she even had a chance to hold him. "It's best," the doctor said when she wailed for her son, and motioned to the nurses to hold Daphne down with a wooden board carved out in the center for her body. "So we don't hurt you. So we don't hurt you, miss." One nurse on either side of the restraint as another whisked Hector from her sight, never to be seen or heard again.
Joyce Kornblatt. For 25 years, she was at the University of Maryland in College Park and professor of English and creative writing. And now she lives in the Blue Mountains in Australia with her husband. And she has been a Buddhist meditation instructor and is a retired psychotherapist. She has 5 novels under her belt, as well as many other pieces of writing. She's an award-winning writer. I want to talk about tragedy because someone wouldn't think, well, you know, it's not really a classic tragedy. But I want your thoughts on this because I was talking to some people today about the book. And we were saying, you know, one philosopher says that tragedy is a conflict of ethics. Another philosopher says that it's the irrational mind against a rational mind. Now, those are 2 very broad things, but somehow they both fit your book. There's an irrational mind, there is a rational mind. There is an ethical question butting against another ethical question. I thought we had the best discussion today. I wish you were there. So is your book a tragedy? Or are Hegel and Nietzsche wrong?
I don't think they're wrong. I hope it's a redeemed tragedy in the broadest sense. It's obviously not a book in which terrible things turn out to be fantasies. Terrible things happen. There is a huge amount of suffering in this book. But there is a kind of redemption at the end because there is a reunion, a making things right. And there's another way in which I think it is a redeemed book, and that is that the writer herself, Nella Pine, finds in the very act of writing the antidote to tragedy.
And don't we all?
And don't we all?
And that is a blessing. Art saves, if ever. There's a truer statement, art saves. No, but I must say, the risks in this book make the action in the book. Risk is action. And the risks that happen in the book that you take are what keeps moving the book. So that's really an important word you just used, I think.
Yes, and until I had the courage to take the risks myself that would allow the characters to take their risks, I couldn't really move the book forward in a way that felt that it had the kind of depth that I wanted.
Oh, that is such an important statement. I just hope every writer, I'm going to make that statement available to every writer, until you could take the risks, your characters could not take the risks. Gosh, that is it. That's it. Yes. You never teach another thing. Caraggio, right?
Yes, this is what I've learned as a teacher of writing for decades and as a writer myself, that you are not separate from your characters, even if they are fictional characters. They emerge from your psyche, from your soul, from your mind. and they ask of you what you are asking of them on the page.
Great. But, you know, there's also the fact that this is a story which happens all the time in the newspapers. So but I've never read a novel about it. So in another way, you have a gigantic wish and longing to tell a story. But then I think you've hit upon it, a kind of an unusual story that I do not think has been covered in fiction. So that must have come into play.
I don't think it has much. And so it did feel like very alien territory to me. I think I had read a newspaper account at some point during the writing, not before the writing.
In the newspaper, but not
in the newspapers. Yeah. But no, never in fiction. You know, you might read novels about kidnappings, but not of infants, not of newborns.
Well, we want to hear a final reading, please, of this fascinating book.
Thank you, Grace. Well, these are just the very first pages from the Leah section. Leah is Mela, known to her as Naomi's birth sister in Pittsburgh. They have just spoken on the phone for the first time. And they are preparing to actually meet each other in person. So Leah, all these years, never knowing the fate of her abducted sister until now. You called yesterday. You said, "Hello, Leah, this will be a shock." It wasn't. I'd spent my whole life waiting for you to come back, Naomi. I imagined you find me on a bus or at the library or in my classroom at school. You tap me on the shoulder 3 times, I dreamed. I would turn around to see you there. You would look serious and grave. "Hello, Leah," you would say. And on the phone you did. "Hello, Leah." Finally, I could rest. You called. As if I'd held my breath for 44 years. And now I could exhale. "Hello, Leah." What could feel more natural? One sister greeting another. It never occurred to me you wouldn't find us. Others said you were likely dead or could never trace your way back to us. I knew they were wrong. How did I know this? How do you know the sun will rise again after it vanishes at night? There is an order in things. I trusted that. It was your absence that was the shock. Mom went to the hospital, birthed you, and came home shattered. I was 6 years old. "Where is our baby? Where is Naomi?" I asked. Dad said I couldn't keep asking. "It will make her very sick," he said, as if my questions were the cause of her suffering, as if silencing me could take her pain away, or his. He spoke for her, but as the years went on, I could see that taking care of Deborah was Dad's way of keeping the attention away from himself. He could pretend he was coping while she was not doing well. A friend would phone, a neighbor would stop by, a relative would invite us over for Sunday brunch. His reply was always the same, "I'm sorry, but she's not doing well." In time, I learned all the words that explained how we suffered. Post-traumatic stress disorder, codependency, complicated grief. And of course, your name, Naomi, which was also the word of our cure. Dad is dead. Mom has lost her memory. So I'm the only one left to receive the blessing of your return. "It would be a miracle," our mother used to say, imagining how it would be if you came back to us, realizing she didn't believe you would. "She won't come back," I'd answer, stroking her hair, wiping away her tears with my fingers. She would shake her head, as if to say she knew I was saying that to prop her up. But it wasn't like that at all. To me, it was a fact, as ordinary as the knowledge that the seasons would turn. Shall I read a little more, or is that?
I love that. No, that is such a satisfying reading. And you have such a voice. You must make a CD of this. I feel you just make me relax all over. And that was the voice. It is the voice of Joyce Cornblatt. Mother Tongue is the book. And this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The series is produced by Forest Woods Media Production. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Sinipet Fund, by Natalie Canavore, and by Sandy Jackson Cohen. Mike Turpin is our engineer, and I'm Grace Cavalieri.
Listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM.
Goodbye.
KBOO Community Radio couldn't do it without you. Support KBOO by becoming a member during our Wake Up the Neighborhood fall membership drive, taking place now.